And we're holding on page 56 in Yoma, about three or four lines from the bottom of the page, middle of our Samach Gimel. We were learning about the Urim V'Tumim and how they worked. We're going to really talk about today, but what was the procedure for asking them and the rules you need to know before you ask them. For us nowadays, in a way, it may be easier to understand this Gemara than it would in olden times. You can think of the Urim V'Tumim as lahavdil, like a computer. You have the chas v'shalom, to use the same expression, but they have the expression in computerese, garbage in, garbage out. You ask the wrong thing, you're going to get the wrong answer. And here it is over here also. You got to know what to ask and how to ask it. So now the Gemara continues. This is a long braisa that's describing the procedure with the Urim V'Tumim. Now, even though we sometimes find that what a Navi says is retracted, we know that if a Navi says a Nevuah that something bad is going to happen, it's not necessarily Hashem can be Erech HaPayim, the people can be Tshuva, etc. But the rule, whatever it said, whatever the Urim V'Tumim says is going to happen, that never gets retracted. It's always going to happen exactly the way it says. Shenemba b'mishpat ha'urim, as the pasuk describes, the pasuk calls it the judgment of the Urim. So it's like a judgment that doesn't get reversed. Now, why taka should that be so? What happens if the people do tshuva? So the Abai Banel, actually on the Pesukim, says a reason, because he says the Urim V'Tumim is meant for short-term predictions. You don't ask the Urim V'Tumim what's going to be a long time from now. You ask it, should we go to war, etc., that kind of thing. So not very likely that from when they ask the Urim V'Tumim till they actually go to war, there's going to be such a turnover that the Eivishter will change the Gzera. It doesn't really seem, it seems a little hard to understand, because we say, after all, a person can do tshuva b'shaita chadu b'riga. In one moment, person can transform himself in a kata la kata, but that's how the Abba now explains it. Ben Yehoyada gives a different reason. He says, because the whole concept of how the Urim V'Tumim works is a nest. The Eivishter doesn't do a nest for nothing. So if he were to give an answer with Bederach Nest with the Urim V'Tumim, and then it doesn't come true, then it would be that he did a nest for nothing, and therefore, yeah. So why are they called Urim V'Tumim? Urim shem irim es divrehem. They're called Urim because they light up their words. Now Rashi says doesn't mean light up as in the stones light up. We are going to talk about soon how exactly the Kohen Gadol would see the message on the Choshen. But Rashi just learns me'irim means they clearly state what their answer is. And tumim shem ashlumim l'divrehem is they're called tumim meloshin tam meloshin complete because their words are complete and perfect. Like we said, the gzera never goes back. The Ritva gives a different explanation over here, and he says that they're called Urim and Tumim respectively, in the sense that you had to have there were Urim in this in that the letters light up, and that Tumim and that as the Gemara is going to say soon, they would stick out of the Choshen. The Kohen Gadol would see them sticking out, and then he needs to know how to put the letters in the right order. That's Tumim. So according to him, those are two different parts of how it actually works. But the Ritva also mentions over here in this connection, you have a number of different explanations from the Ritva that I brought over here. He also mentions in this connection the stones on the Choshen. Now we know you had the stones on the Ephod. We know you had the 12 stones on the Choshen, each with the name of a Shevet. You also had the names of the Shvatim on the two stones of the Ephod, six on each stone. It's mashma from the way that the Ritva says it, that those factored into it as well, that the message would come not only on the Choshen, but also on the stones of the Ephod. On the two shoulder straps of the ephod. Most other Rishonim don't learn that way. They just it would only be the stones on the choshen. Okay, the imtoimah. Now you're going to ask if the Urim V'Tumim always gives a reliable answer, but give us binyamin if malo hishlimu. Then why by Giva Spinyamin, why when they went to war against Giva for the whole story with Pelagish B'Giva, why did the answer not work out? So we have to review a little bit what happened in the Pesukim over there. So after you have the whole story of Pelegish Begiva, how she was raped and assaulted and killed, etc. So everybody's outraged and they're going to war against Shevet Binyamin. They ask the Urim V'Tumim, and they ask him who should go up first, who should lead the battle. And Hashem says Yehuda. So they go and they fight against Binyamin. 22,000 soldiers from the other Shevatim are killed. They try again the next day. They ask, should we continue to go to war against Binyamin? Hashem says, yes, go ahead. And they go, and the next day, 18,000 more soldiers are killed. Then they're partially going to pieces, they're fasting, they're davening, or whatever. Then they ask the Urim V'Tumim, and they're crying. They ask the Urim V'Tumim, should we continue going to war, or should we stop? And Hashem says, go, and I'm going to give them over into your hand. And sure enough, the third day, they fight against Shevet Binyamin, and they wipe out almost the entire Shevet. So what happened the first two times, then, on the face of it? If the Urim V'Tumim always gives a reliable answer, how is it that on the first two days, they lost 40,000 men? So actually, there's a Gemara in Shavuos where the Gemara is discussing over there which names of Hashem that are mentioned. We have always the question, we have the name Elikim. Does it refer to Hashem, or Lahavdol, does it refer to Avodah Zarah? So the Gemara discusses that in Shavuos, and it mentions that, so in connection with this whole story of Giva, you have several times, Vayishalu by Elikim, or even Vayishalu by Hashem, Rabbi Eliezer learns, because of this question, the first two times they didn't ask the genuine Urim V'Tumim. They actually asked something of Avodah Zarah, he learns. And therefore he learns that Elikim, and maybe even the Shem Havaya over there, refers to, for example, Pesel Micha. Micha over there is, after all, claiming that his statue is meant to represent the power of Hashem, and it has an ephod and teraphim in connection with it. So he learns the first two times they're asking that. No wonder they got an answer that didn't work out. Rabbi Yeshua tells him no, as the Gemara is going to answer over here. They ask the question the wrong way the first two times. But you have Bechlau, there are Rishonim who learn, besides for the Choshen that was made originally by Moshe Rabbeinu, and as the Ritva is saying over here, you had the name of Hashem that was put between the folds of it that made it work. There are Rishonim who learn that there were other, on the side of Kedusha, there were other Ephods and Choshens as well that were available for people to be able to use, because the same way as Hashem told Moshe the secret of how to write that Shema Mefurish to make the Choshen work, the same way there were people in that time who also had this idea of how to do that, and they were also able to make Choshens like that would work in the same way Mitzad Kedusha. Then you also have people who would make the Mitzad Atuma. You find in a few places in Nach, you find where they had ephods that were used as things involved with Avodah Zarah. So in that case, so Rebbe Eliezer is saying over there that the first two times they asked one of those. And only the third time did they finally go and ask the genuine one, or one of the genuine ones at least. Rabbi Yeshua says that no, and the Gemara is saying over here, the Brice over here is following his opinion. The problem was Heim Shalei Bichanu Im Linsoyach Im Linatseach, because the first two times they didn't think to ask whether they're asking if they should go to war, but they're not asking, are we going to win the war? The first time they're B'chlan not even asking if they should go to war. The first time they're just saying who should go first. In other words, it's a given we're going to war. Who should leave the battle? And the Eivishter is answering through the Urim V'Tumim. Well, you know, Yehuda always goes first. Fine, you're asking the wrong question, you're going to get the wrong answer. The second time they asked, should we go? But they didn't think to ask, should we hold back? So fine, you want to go, go goes up to hate. I'm not going to tell you what's going to actually happen. The third time they're finally realizing to ask whether they should go or whether they should not go. In other words, are they going to win or are they going to lose? Now the Eivishter tells them, go and tomorrow you'll win. The third time they finally got, they finally realized to ask the question correctly. Then the Urim V'Tumim agreed with what they wanted and told them the correct forecast that they are going to win, which in fact they did. Shenema, as the Pesukim say, the third time when they came to ask, or Finchas ben Elazar ben Aaron omen the fun of Bayom Mahim, that there was the Aaron over there, and Pinchas ben Elazar was standing before the Aaron in those days. He was the Kohen Gadol. Lamer, and they asked him, how Osef Oid Lotzis Lamochama in Bnei Binyamin Achi, should I continue to go to war with the descendants of Binyamin, my brother, Im Echdal, or should I hold back? And Hashem says, through the Urim V'Tumim, go up, because tomorrow I'll give them into your hands. So we see, in other words, the point is that, so according to Rabbi Eliezer B'chlal, the first two times they weren't even asking the genuine Urim V'Tumim, they're asking an Avodah Zarah Dika one. So of course, Pinchas is not involved. The third time they finally went and asked Pinchas. According to Rabbi Yeshua, that all three times they were asking the genuine Urim V'Tumim, the difference is, Maushal explains, the first two times they had some other Kohen wear the Urim V'Tumim and ask him, and he didn't know to give them the instructions of how to ask the question properly. The third time they made sure that Pinchas is involved, and he knows the relevant halachas that we just discussed, and therefore he knew how to ask the question. The first two times, that's what we're saying, according to Rabbi Yeshua, and this is what this Braisa is saying, they did ask the Urim V'Tumim all three times, just the first two times, right, they asked the question the wrong way, right. So that's the deal. It's not that the Urim V'Tumim gives a wrong answer, but it gives an answer to what you asked. And if you don't ask the right question, you're not going to get the right answer. Like a computer in that sense. Okay. Kate said Gnosis. How did it work? How did the Urim V'Tumim actually work? How did the Kohen get the message? Rabbi Yochanan says the letters would stick out. So Rashi gives an example. Let's say, for example, the word is supposed to be Aleh, go up. So then you'd have the Ayin of Shimon, the Lamed of Levi, the Hay of Yehuda would stick out. Like this, all the letters were engraved into the stones on the, not really engraved actually, because you can't use iron tools. They were all sunken under the, below the level of the face of the stone using the Shamir. So now what would happen is, B'derech Nes, each one of those sunken in letters would stick out in order, and the ones that are sticking out would form the message. Rabbi Shimon Lakish, Omer Mitztafris, and Mish Lakish said they would combine together. Meaning, in other words, so according to Mish Lakish, they would actually, the way Rashi learns, they would actually move from their places and form a complete word. That's according to... And Maushaw adds also, so then obviously according to the Shlokish, that Mitztafis means they come out in the correct order. According to Rabbi Yochanan, that Boltus, they only stick out very well. In Rashi's example, they happen to be in the right order. Ayin from Shimon, Lamed from Levi, Hay from Yehuda. What happens if they're out of order? So for that, Maushaw says they would stick out one after the other, each one, and that way the message could be read in order. So for example, again, you don't have to have the ayin. So you don't have to have the you could have, for example, a different the message could be spelled out using different letters from all over the Choshen, and each one would stick out in turn, and that would tell them the order in which to say it. That's according to Rashi. The Ritva talks about over here that no, what it is that actually, again, part of the fact of why it's called Urim V'Tumim, the double name, is because they would light up, but then they have to be combined. The Kohen had to have Ruach HaKodesh to know how to combine the letters properly, meaning that they would all light up at once, and then the Kohen Gadol needs to know how to arrange the letters in the correct order. Which then, according to him, it comes out that Rish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan are not really arguing per se, they're describing two different stages in how it works. There is a very famous explanation they bring from the Vilna Gaon in that connection that explains, he uses that to explain the story with Eli and Chan. So Chan is going over there and davening for a child, and Eli Bishikoda, and Eli sees her standing over there, and he thinks she's drunk, and he starts yelling at her, and she tells him, no, I'm davening for a child, and he says, you're right, I was choshed b'ksheirim, I'm asking you mechila, and I'm giving you a bracha. What happened over here that he misunderstood her in the first place? So the Vilna Gaon brings a vort based on this. He asked the Choshen, he asked the Urim V'Tumim, what's the story with this woman? And the letters that lit up for him were Hey, Chof, Resh, and Shin. Now he rearranged those, you have to rearrange them, that doesn't spell out a word. He rearranged it to spell out Shikora. So he thought the Urim V'Tumim is telling him she's drunk. She's telling him Lo Yadoni. No, you don't have the proper Ruach HaKodesh, as the Gemara tells us in Brachas, that's by saying Lo Yadoni, she was hinting to him, you don't have the proper Ruach HaKodesh. It's supposed to be rearranged to spell Chof Shin Resh Hey, which can spell either Ksheira or Kisara, a woman who was of the caliber of Sarah. If you had the proper Ruach HaKodesh, you would have realized that, and he would have realized that I'm no Shikora. So that fits with what the Ritva is explaining over here, that the letters would light up all at once, and the Kohen Gadol needs to have the Ruach HaKodesh to combine them together. Then I'm right somewhat similarly in Hilchos Klei HaMikdash. There's a beautiful sikha where the Rebbe talks about the deeper idea, right, that she's davening for a child, she's davening for something that she needs, a gashmiistic need, and it's Rosh Hashanah, and Avi thinks that it's not right on this day to be davening about that, you have to be davening to Moloi Chala Olam Kula Bichvedecha, and therefore he's accusing her of being drunk on gashmiist, and she's telling him, no, I'm davening not for myself, but that I should be able to bring Elikus into the world, and he realizes his mistake. The question is, how do you spell out a message with the Choshen, Haloiksi Bahut Tzadim? There's no letter Tzadik in any of the names of the Shvatim. So if you have a message that needs to have the letter Tzadik, and we had an example yesterday where the Urim V'Tumim tells David, Redoif ki hasik tasik v'hatzil tatzil, where's the Tzadik? Because on the Choshen, in addition to the names of the Shvatim, it also said Avraham Yitzchak V'Yakov. We have machlokas. We showed him how it was written. The Gemara is going to mention also. Well, wait. So v'holi k'siv tes. What about there's no letter tes either? Amar Rav Ach BaYakov shivta yeshurun k'siv sham. It also said the words shivta yeshurun. There are different gifsois among the Rishonim, whether it was shivta yeshurun or shivta ka or shivta yisrael or something like that. Whatever. It had the word shivta, which contains a tes. Tosfos Hashanim points out, when you get down to it, the Gemara could have also asked the question about Ches and Kuf. Those letters aren't, and then you have four letters, Tzadik, Ches, Kuf, and Tes, that are not in the names of the Shvatim. Once we answer about Yitzchak, then that takes care of the Ches and Kuf as well. Cute thing in that regard, in connection with where we're next week's parasha, Vayichi, when we know when Yaakov wants to give, wants to tell, he wants to, he gathers together all the Shvatim, and he wants to tell them when the Ketz is going to be, when Mashiach is going to come, and then he can't, and then he can't. It was hidden away from him. So we know, the Gemara tells us, he asked them, is there maybe anybody among you who doesn't believe in the Eibishter? And they all answered Shema Yisrael, and he answered Baruch Shem. So Bala Turim says a cute thing on it. He says to them, is there anybody who did Averis among you? They say, Tati, not only do we not have any Averis, but you look at the letters of our names, there's no Ches and Tes in there. The word Chet, you can't even make out of the letters of our names, because there's no Ches and no Tes among the names of the Shvatim. And Yaakov says, that's true. But you know what? There's also, in your names, there's also missing the letters of Ketz. So therefore, I'm not able to tell you the Ketz. Anyway, so the point is that all four of those letters are made up by writing Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and writing Shivtei Yeshurun or Shivtei Ka, or whatever the gear says. Yeah. So where was it written? So you have two different opinions. The Rambam learns that the words of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were written above the name of Reuven on his stone, on the Odem, and the Shivtei Yeshurun, or Shivtei Kor, whatever, were written underneath Binyamin's name on the last stone, on Yoshve. On the other hand, so that's the point of the Rambam, there is an opinion that's brought by a couple of the Rishonim, the Rabbi Nebuchadnezzar brings it, after the Baal HaTurim brings it as well, that what they did is they distributed the letters among the stones so that each stone had six letters. So Reuven, for example, they put together with Reuven the Aleph of Avraham. Shimon is also five letters, they put together with it the Beis of Avraham. Levi is three letters, so they put the rest of the name Resh Hey Mem, and so forth with the rest of them, until you come to Binyamin. Binyamin's name, the first time when he's born, his name is written Mali. Most of the time, most places after that, in Tanakh, his name is usually written Choser, without the second Yud, but the first time when he's born, it's written with both Yuds. That's how it's written on the Choshen. So that's six letters, so nothing else goes with it. So according to that, there were 72 letters on the Choshen, six per stone. Anyway, the point is they had all the letters. Ben Yehoyada talks about over here, so Taka, why did the Gemara, Tes comes in the Aleph Beis before Tzadik, why did the Gemara ask about, there's no Tzadik before it asked about Tes? And he says a couple of points. First of all, there's no letter in the Aleph Beis that really resembles Tzadik. Tes, at least, you could say, but Dochuk, so maybe you have some, you have a Mem, for example, looks very much like a Tes. So maybe if you need a message that has to have a Tes, then instead of a Mem could substitute for it. But Tzadik, you really don't have. Second of all, he says, the fact is, you find in a number of places in Tanakh where Yitzchak's name is written Yitzchak with a sin. We have in Tilim, for example, Ashakara Savram, Ushvase the Yitzchak, and there are a few other places in Tanakh that way. So the Gemara was thinking, to begin with, that maybe his name, maybe the names of the are written on the Choshen, but maybe not Yitzchak, but rather Yitzchak, and therefore it's saying, no, it was written with a tzadik. So the Gemara says, Maisvi, I have a contradiction. If you're telling me that the letters on the stones would stick out and they'd be in the proper order or whatever it is, according to the Shlokesh or Rabbi Yechanan, how it would work. A braisa says, Kol koyin shemadaba b'ruach ha-kodesh or shechina shoda olav, any koyin who is able to speak with ruach ha-kodesh and where the shechina rests on him, Sholem boy, only that kind, you can ask him the Urim V'Tumim, and we have an example. Shari Shalt Sodik for Ololoi, V'Shal of Yosef Ole Ololoi. We have an example. Now, if Yosef had been the Kohen Gadol for quite some time, this happened during the time when David was running away from Avshalom. So Avyosser had been the Kohen Gadol for many years before that. His family had been wiped out in Noiv by Shaul, by Doeg under the instructions of Shaul. So Avyosser was the only survivor. He became the new Kohen Gadol. By this, that was before David had actually started his kingship. Then he became Kohen Gadol and he served as Kohen Gadol throughout most of the 40 years of David's kingship. Now it's 35 or 36 or so years into David's kingship. So you have, it describes over there when David is running away from Yerushalayim to get someplace safe from Avshalom. So it describes the Kohenim brought the Oren at that point, the Oren was in the Beis Mikdash, hadn't yet been built. There was a tent for the Oren that David had set up in Yerushalayim. And so now they brought the Oren, figuring that it'll go along with David wherever he's wandering to. And then they also had the Urim V'Tumim with him. So the Pasuk says they had the Oren over there, Shanema, Vayal of Yosef. The Pasuk says of Yosef went up. So it means, in other words, that what it means is, it actually brings from Seder Olam, what happened was, David asked of Yosser, please ask the Urim V'Tumim for me, what's the story, where should I go, what should I do, and if Yosser asks, and he doesn't get a response. So then they realized he's lost his Ruach HaKodesh. So now instead it was transferred to Tzadik HaKoyin, who was it. And then so he took over as the new Kohen Gadol. Eventually it was made more official. David tells Shlomo before he passes away, after the Parshas Vayechi, that of Yosser has to be, I don't think he mentions of Yosser over there, but you need Ruach HaKodesh. That's what we're saying. And that's the question. If the letters stick out and the letters go in the correct order, what do you need Ruach? And the letters stick out. So what do you need Ruach HaKodesh in order to interpret it? That's the question. So anyway, the point is of Yosser. When after David passed away, then Shlomo tells of Yosser, you were involved in Adoniyahu's rebellion. So you are demoted permanently as Kohen Gadol. You go to your city of Anosis and Tzadik will take over as the exclusive Kohen Gadol. The point was, though, that now we're saying, so a couple of years before that already, Tzadik had gained the Ruach HaKodesh, that of Yosser lost, and therefore Tzadik is now the one who's able to wear the Urim V'Tumim and to be asked then. So we see you need Ruach HaKodesh. This was all, by the way, in connection with the fact of Yosser was descended from Eli, and many years earlier, Hashem had sent Nevuos to Eli, first through Elkanah, then through Shmuel, that Eli and his family are going to be demoted from their position because of the way Eli's children, Chofni and Pinchas, had acted at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. So now this started coming true many decades later, and that's why Tzadik, on the other hand, is descended from Pinchas, descended from Elazar and from Pinchas, and he's the one that the Kohuna Gdola goes to him and continues in his family from then until the end. Anyway, the question is that why should the Kohen Gadol need Ruach HaKodesh in order to read what the Urim V'Tumim says? If we're saying the letters are boltus, they're sticking out, then anybody should be able to see it. If we're saying that they're mitstarfus, like Rish Lakish says, they actually move and combine to form a word, then anybody can read it. What do you need Ruach HaKodesh for? And the answer is the Messiah Siuri Badai. The answer is the Kohen Gadol's Ruach HaKodesh needs to work together with the Urim V'Tumim. If you have the Urim V'Tumim and the Kohen Gadol has the proper Ruach HaKodesh, then the letters will stick out and combine and do whatever they're supposed to do. If the Kohen Gadol does not have that degree of Ruach HaKodesh, then even though you have the Choshen, you have the Urim V'Tumim, and you have everything you need, but without his Ruach HaKodesh, it still won't work. The letters won't stick out or combine or do whatever they're supposed to do. So that's why you need Ruach HaKodesh. And then when Yosser didn't have it anymore, then they had to take away the right to ask the Urim V'Tumim from him and give it to Tzadik instead. Okay. Piska, continuing, the Mishnah had said, Ve'en nish'olim behem lahedyet. You don't just have a regular person can't ask the Urim V'Tumim. Ela l'melech, or l'beistin, or l'av beistin, or l'mish tzorech ha-tzibur boy, the king, the av beistin, or anybody whom the tzibur needs, for example, a general. Is able to ask the Urim V'Tumim. So Menahani Mili, where do we know this from? Amar Ababohu, Amar Kro, because the pasuk describes when Hashem tells Moshe to appoint Yoshua as the next leader of the Jewish people. Hashem tells him, "Lefnei Elazar Akoyin Yamud, Yoshua will stand in front of Elazar, v'shal loy v'gomer, and he'll ask him in with Mishpat Ta'urim, which we said before. The Urim V'Tumim are called Mishpat because it's an irrevocable thing, and the pasuk says. The pasuk continues. They'll go out to war and they'll come back from war based on what he says. Who v'chol bnei Yisrael itay v'chol ha'eda. The pasuk says he, all of bnei Yisrael with him, and the whole eda, the whole congregation. So who is a melech? The word who refers to the king. The word v'chol bnei Yisrael itay is a meshuach melchama. When it says all the Jewish people with him. Refers to the Mashuach Melchama, which is all the Jewish people go with him when they're going to war. He goes with them. He's the one who gives the speeches. He's the one who gives the speeches telling who should go home and Shema Yisrael and all of that. So he's the one who has all the Jewish people with him. And B'chola Eda is a Sanhedrin. And when it finishes off, in the whole Eda, we know in many places where the Eda that refers to the Sanhedrin, that's what it means over here. So the Sanhedrin, or particularly the Av Beis Din, who represents the Sanhedrin, is entitled to ask the Urim V'Tumim. HaKosev mentions over here one point, which is in parenthesis here in Rashi, you should read it based on a Gemara in Eruvin, that you can't ask the Urim V'Tumim for a Dvar Heter V'Isur. You can't ask it to give you a Psak Halacha, because Torah Lo B'Shamayimi. So you're asking it whether should we go to war or whatever, what's going to happen next, but not when it comes to a matter of halacha, then you have to ask the rabbi. Okay. Yom HaKippurim Perek Shmini. And then, by the way, the Ritva mentions one more point over here in connection with the Urim V'Tumim, which is something that the Rambam brings at the end of Hilchos Klei HaMikdash. You find various people in Tanakh who wore an ephod even though they weren't kohenim. We find Shmuel wearing one. We find David wearing one. So he brings from Tosfos, and then the Rambam says basically the same thing, that this was not the ephod with the Urim V'Tumim. It was a garment made similar to the ephod and of the Kohen Gadol, and it demonstrated that this person is on the mila of having Ruach HaKodesh like we just said the Kohen Gadol has to have. So it was like the uniform of the Baalei Ruach HaKodesh then. And again, sometimes you do find in Tanakh they also had ephods that were made as accessories for Avodah Zarah. We find one in Gideon's times. We find one in connection with Pesel Micha. But then you have the genuine one that the Kohen Gadol wore. Again, you have Rishonim that learned there were other genuine ones complete with Urim B'Tumim that other great people were able to wear and to use as well. And then you had an ephod like garment made out of linen, which Baalei Ruach HaKodesh, for example, Shmuel and David wore. Yom HaKippurim Perek Shmini. This Perek now, the first seven Perekim, have talked all about the Avoda of the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur, which we don't have now until the Beis Mikdash is built, Meher of Yamenu. But the eighth Perek focuses on Yom Kippur as we do it in all times and all places, the fasting, the other Inuyim, and so forth. So now, when you think about it, the Torah never says in so many words to fast on Yom Kippur. What it says is Ta'anu es nafshi seichem. So the first thing we got to establish is what does Ta'anu mean exactly? So that's Tana Rabbanan. We learn in a Braisa. When it says Ta'anu es nafshi seichem, when it says you should afflict your souls, Yocho yeshe b'chamoy b'tzina kodesh yitzar. Maybe that means that you have to sit in the heat or in the cold in order to feel uncomfortable. Talmud Loma, no, because the pasuk continues v'chol melacha lo sasu. The pasuk continues that also on Yom Kippur you're not allowed to do melacha. Ma melacha shev v'al taseh. So just like with melacha means something that you have to sit and not do it, something that the rest of the time you'd be doing. And now Hashem is telling on Yom Kippur, don't do it. Af inu nefesh shev v'al taseh. The same way the inu nefesh has to be something passive. So it has to be something where you would have otherwise done something and now you're not going to. So if you go and sit in the heat or in the cold, then you're doing something. That's the opposite. So therefore, that's the opposite of not doing melacha. Well, the Gemara says, okay, but v'heima hecha de yosef beit shimsha v'chamim lo neim le kum tur betula. Maybe it means if a person is already sitting in the sun at a time he's hot, we tell him, don't stay there. Don't get up and sit in the shade. Yosef Betula, or if right now he's sitting in the shade of a korer there and he's feeling cold, lo neimale kum tur b'shimsha. We should tell him, don't get up and sit in the sun to warm up. So that would be a passive thing. That would be like staying away from malacha. So maybe that's the inner Yom Kippur. And the answer is still Jumya de Malacha. It has to be completely similar to Malacha. Ma Malacha lechilakdeba. When it comes to Malacha, there's never a distinction. Malacha is always doing something, and then not doing Malacha is always a passive thing, not doing something. The same way you can have. In other words, if right now the person is sitting in the sun and he's uncomfortable, and we're going to tell him don't get out of this discomfort, but on the other hand, you may have another person who is already sitting in a comfortable place, and if we tell him go and sit in an uncomfortable place, then that's not the same as not doing malacha. Therefore, it has to be across whatever the inui is, it has to be something that's going to be the same for everybody across the board, not depending on where you are at the beginning before you start the inui of Yom Kippur. Therefore, it can't mean anything about sun and shade and being uncomfortable like that. It has to be things that are described in the Torah as inui. So the Gemara goes on to deal with exactly how we learn that Inui refers to the various Chamisha, the Chamisha Inui of Yom Kippur. One point is, the Gemara mentions in that connection a pasuk about the mon. Vayancha vayarivecha, that Hashem afflicted you and he made you hungry, and then he gave you the mon. So we learn from that that being hungry is considered an Inui. So now the Gemara goes into some agadja about that. The pasuk says Hashem gave you to eat mon in the midbar in order to afflict you. You have another pasuk that Hashem afflicted you and made you hungry. So the way we have it in front of us, the girsa would be that it's pointing out a contradiction between the two pesukim. What is it? Was the eating the mon the affliction, or was the being hungry the affliction? Rashi though says that no, the correct girsa is the Gemara is not pointing out a contradiction between the pesukim. It's just explaining in what way is eating the mon, how can that be described as an inui? The fasting, the being hungry, fine, that's an inui, as we just said, and that's on Yom Kippur. But why should eating the mon be considered an inui? So Rav Ami and Rav Asi. So Rav Ami and Rav Asi argue what that pasuk means. Chad Omer, one of them says, because you can't compare a person who has bread in his basket to a person who does not. Meaning, in other words, when you have like this, when a person has food for tomorrow, then when he eats today, he feels much more comfortable about it. Okay, I can eat whatever I want today. I still have more for tomorrow. When he doesn't, then he feels nervous about it. If I eat all my food today, I may not have any for tomorrow. With the mun, they were doing that on a daily basis. Every single day, they have only food for that day, because of course they can't leave mun from one day over to the next. And therefore, in that sense, it's an inui, the fact that they're eating, but there's that constant worry, is there going to be mun tomorrow? Now, later on, the sugya, the Gemara is going to explain, that is exactly why the Eivishta did that, in order to teach them that bitachon. There's a famous expression, a medrash, in fact, where Rabbi Eliezer says that even nowadays, if a person has what he needs for today, but not for any worries about what's going to be tomorrow, then he's mechose, he's miktane amone, he's one of the people who has less emuna than he should. So here, the Eibishter wanted to inculcate that into the Jewish people for 40 years straight, that's how a Yid has to think. Ion Yaakov points out another point over here as well, that the purpose of eating the mon was to make them ready to receive the Torah, l'nitna Torah, l'okhle amon. And that's the kind of thing when a person one of the aborim shmona dvarim that the Torah is niknes behem, as we say in Pirkei Avos, is miut tainug. So therefore, the Eibishter had to put them in a situation where they have less tainug in their eating than they otherwise would.
Meaning, if they're not eating tomorrow, they don't really got it.
No, well, they can't keep it for tomorrow, because after Dustin and Avidim tried it the first time, it got wormy. But the point is, therefore, after that, everybody realized you have to eat it all today. You can't leave over for tomorrow. But as the Gemara points out later in the sugya, Reb Shimon ben Yochai tells us Tamidim, the fact is, everybody was constantly living on the edge. What about, so what happens if the Eibishter decides that mon shouldn't fall for us tomorrow? Then we're all going to starve. But instead, that forced them to develop a bitachon in the Eibishter. There will be mon tomorrow. The Eibishter is not going to let us down. That's the tzar, the fact that every day they have that mental nervousness, is there going to be mun tomorrow? And so that's how they develop their emunah. But to begin with, until a person develops that kind of skill, then it's a tzar. Therefore, Moshe can describe it at the end as vayancha, as laman anesecha. So that's one point. Worth mentioning in that connection, by the way, Rashi mentions on a pasuk in Daniel, where they're saying a long tefillah to Hashem, remembering all the good things that Hashem had done for the Jewish people throughout history. They mention the point that you never held back your mon from them. Rashi over there brings, based on a medrash, what happened was when they made the eagle, they actually brought mon as a korban to the eagle. By rights, the Eibishter could have said, you're misusing my mon, I'm not giving it to you tomorrow, and yet it still fell the next day. So the Eibishter never gave up on them, even at a time like that. Anyway, so that's one explanation. The other, between Rav Ami and Rav Asi, says another point as well. There's a big difference whether you see what you're eating versus you don't see it. The mun, the Gemara is going to discuss later on, different opinions. According to one, we know the mun could taste like almost anything you wanted, but according to one Manda Omer, it wouldn't look like it. It would look just like the way it describes it in the pasuk, as this fine, flaky stuff. It would taste like whatever you wanted. So therefore, you're not getting the enjoyment. You're not getting the full enjoyment of being able to see the juicy steak or whatever it is that you're eating. So in that sense, it can be called an inui. Yeah. Rabbi Yosef, mikan remes l'sumen shoichun vein and svein. And Rabbi Yosef says, here you have a hint that blind people, they eat, but they're never fully satisfied. Rabbi Yosef himself was blind, so he knew what he had his own experience to draw on, because he can't see what he's eating. And Amr Abzeira, my krah, what's a posik that expresses that point? Posik and kahelis, toiv mar einayim mehaloch nefesh. Better the seeing of the eyes than the way that a person goes with his desires. Nefesh sometimes means a desire. So in other words, a person has a desire for something, has a taiva for something, but even better is to be able to see it. When he's not able to see it, then he lacks the full pleasure of it. And Omar Abaye, Hilkach, Manda Islay Sodasa, based on this, then if a person has a Soda, Loy Nechle, Elabia Mama, then he should eat it only by day for the same reason. If he eats it by night, he's not gonna fully enjoy it. Now, to be sure, later on, the Gemara points out in the Sugya, it is fine even by night if he eats it by candlelight, because then at least he can see what he's eating. And for that matter, of course, a person can, Marshall points out, a person can eat and be satisfied by night. After all, we have a Seder by night, and when there's a Korban Pesach, then you eat it a la Soiva. So it's not like it's impossible to get filled up by night, but in other words, you'd still get more pleasure of it if you're actually able to see what you're eating. And Ion Yaakov mentions in this connection, this connection, there's a medrash that brings from this pasuk, you have a hint to that, to the concept of Neiros Shabbos Kodesh. Same idea, because if you're eating, you're still down Shabbos, and you don't have candlelight, you don't have light to eat it by, you're not going to have such enjoyment of it. So therefore, that's again, the Eibush to put them through this experience where they're not going to fully enjoy it, in order that this way, again, they have the miut tainug that leads them to being able to be roi to receive the Torah. Rish Lakish gives a different explanation of this pasuk that we quoted, this half pasuk that we quoted, Toiv Mare Enayim, Mehaloch Nefesh. It also means Toiv Mare Enayim Be'isha Yosem Gufa Shel Oisem Maisa. Seeing the beauty of a woman is sometimes better for a person. He has more pleasure from it than the actual Maisa of Znus with her. Shenema, Toiv Mare Enayim, Mehaloch Nefesh. So, in other words, there's a few points in it. For one thing, the actual maaseh itself weakens a person, whereas the sight of it does not. But for that reason, the Gemara mentions earlier in the Masechta, precisely for that reason, hirhure avera, koshen avera, sometimes the hirhur is worse than the actual maaseh for a number of reasons, and one of them is like what we're saying over here, because Itaka has greater hanah from it. There's other points that we talked about over there, because a person doesn't think that hirhur is such a serious thing. So but in any case, the point is that Shloima is telling you should know you get in a way a person can get greater hana from the seeing than from the doing. Yom Yom Mashiach Gola. We started talking about yesterday that Rebbe was talking in a sicha about, even though we'd say any yisrael negolim ela b'tshuva, ein adavar tola ela b'tshuva, there are reasons why to say that even if we don't see that actually happening, that won't hold back the geula. The first one we learned yesterday, because inevitably every yid has had a hero tshuva several times in his life. And the second reason is because nowadays people are not keeping a Torah mitzvahs, are tenokas shenishbu, they're onus rachmana patrei. On the other hand, when those Tinokas Shanishbu keep even one mitzvah, then it's very precious to the Eibishter. And in our generation, we take a see how tens of thousands of Tinokas Shanishbu have returned and continue to return to Darchei HaTorah, and therefore that's a much more precious thing. So there really is Truva going on a constant basis. Yeah, by the way, there was just a video clip going around of some member of the Knesset giving a whole speech over there, saying that she used to think that Mashiach is the Oslo Accords and the this and the that political thing, and now she realizes there really is only the true Mashiach, and that's what we believe in, and that's what we're looking, and he's the one we're looking forward to. So there really is an enormous movement of tshuva going on right now among many people who had no shaychus to it before. So that's what the Rebbe is saying over here. Therefore, even if you think, but there are all those people, not yet, but you should realize that's not going to be ma'akev the geula. The geula amitis vashlema will come based on how things are right now. Miyad mash.
This is right before the geula now.
Okay, continuing on halachas of davening on Shabbos, we talked about yesterday the halacha that if a person starts weekday Shemini Esrei on Shabbos or Yom Tov, he has to finish the bracha that he was in the middle of. So what happens? A person says one word of the bracha, then he's going to have to finish that bracha as well, with the exception of Atah Chayim. Now, if you only said Atah, the fact is, in most of the tefillos of Shabbos, the first bracha, the middle bracha also begins Atah. Atah Kidashta and Atah Echad. So in Ma'ariv or in Mincha, even if he said Ata, intending to say Ata Choinen, he doesn't need to continue Choinen, he can continue Kidashta or Echad, as the case may be. If that happens by Shachris, then it depends. Since the bracha by Shachris doesn't begin Ata, it begins Yismach Moshe, then it depends. If he did it because Taka, he was thinking that it was weekday, then he has to finish Ata Choinen, because now he doesn't have the excuse of saying that the Ata is part of the bracha of Shabbos. But if he knew that it was Shabbos, he's used to saying Atah at this point, after Akela Kodesh, and therefore he said Atah, then he can continue Yismach Moshe from there. Because after all, it's only considered an effect, like he made a bracha from one, like he made a mistake from one tefillah to another. The same way, for example, as if Friday night a person gets to that bracha and starts saying Yismach Moshe and says the whole bracha, but the Yevit, he doesn't have to go back. The same way about Shachas, if he starts saying Ata Kidashta or Ata Echad, whatever, he doesn't have to go back. To that extent, the brachas are considered interchangeable. Similarly, here, when he said Ata, not because he thought it was a weekday, but Stam because he's used to saying Ata, then he's allowed to continue the bracha Yismach Moshe without having to say Ata Chaim. And then, if he only remembers till he got to Ritzei, then he has to break off wherever he remembered and start over with the Shabbos or Yom Tov bracha and finish the Seder. If he only realizes by the time he gets to Yul HaRatzon, then he has to stab and then he has to daven all over again, because then he didn't mention Shabbos in davening at all. Rabbi Chanan Amar Kasha Amar Tzarei Kodesh Baruch Hu.